This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research and activism.
Hello and welcome to the Urban Political, to an episode on the concepts of community and commons. And I'm pleased to welcome three scholars discussing these very relevant notions. Louis Volant, an urban sociologist from Antwerp, Belgium, currently a postdoc at MIT in Boston. Talia Blokland, a professor in urban and regional sociology at the Humboldt University in Berlin. And Thijs Leister, an assistant professor in the philosophy of art and culture at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands and a postdoc at the Culture Commons Quest Office of the University of Antwerp. My name is Markus Kipp, and I'm pleased to host this session today, which is the first one of a new podcast series on key urban concepts. This session will start off with Louis and Thijs laying out their conceptualization of community and the commons, followed by a discussion with Talia on the implications for urban research and action. So to get us going, Louis, why do you think the notion of community is still relevant today?
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Markus, for the introduction. Going right into it, why is community an important concept for urban research and politics? Well, I would say, or better, we would say, Thijs and I, because of its contradictory nature. Well, on the one hand, and that's what I mean with contradictory, you might say that community has become a sort of sexy buzzword, you might say, in research, in urban politics and activism. I would say there's this whole array of terms, inclusion, participation, community, that activists and politicians are working around nowadays. That's on the one hand, but on the other hand, and we will talk about it more during the episode, this idea of community can also, or also has, a dark history. It can be equated with static entities based on nation, ethnicity, religion, creed. So this is a contradiction in itself, community. It can, let's say, meander between inclusion and exclusion, between horizontality and hierarchy. So that's why it's super relevant, I would say, for research and politics. To go to the central claim also of this podcast, which would be like that community is a doing together and not an owning together. Some sort of conceptual fine-tuning at this moment might be good. So we have commons, community, commoning. I thought it might be good to disentangle these terms a little bit from each other. Like what do they mean? How do they interact? What are their resonances for urban research? Maybe you could start off by saying something about this triad, commons, community, commoning. How do they relate? How do they differ? What could be some thoughts on that?
In the literature of the commons, you have this kind of classic source of Eleanor Ostrom, who talks about certain, what she calls common pool resources. So a kind of shared wealth, and she mentions some examples like fishing ponds or water wells or forests and so forth, in which the main rule is that you can use these sources as long as you also contribute to the reproduction of it. So this has, of course, been a hugely influential theory and a hugely influential take. And Ostrom, in many ways, has put the commons back on the agenda, you might say. But there's has also been, I guess, a kind of tendency to consider commons as particular kinds of things or indeed resources. In which case it's sometimes obscured or neglected that commons also need to be continuously reproduced, recreated, managed. And that is also why some other theorists have argued that we should rather speak of commoning as a verb instead of commons as a kind of a noun. So this is, for instance, in the book that David Harvey wrote on rebel cities, he particularly applies this also to an urban context in which commoning is the kind of reclaiming of spaces, especially urban spaces, as commons. So he considers to be he considers commoning as a kind of force that moves opposed to privatization. So while privatization is indeed this process of enclosure and as it were bracketing off commons from shared use, commoning is the kind of opposed movement in which communities actually again open up spaces. So then we have commons and we have commoning, and there are actually several theorists also that point out that the commons actually consists of three parts or three ingredients, you might say, that you indeed in the first place have a common resource, so the common pool resource that Ostrom was talking about, then you have the activity of commoning, and last but not least, you also have a community of people who are actually doing the work of the commoning, so to say. So perhaps to make it very simple and tangible, if you take the example of an urban community garden, then you have the resource, which is the ground, the actual garden, the things that that grow on it. Then you have the activity of commoning, which is the gardening that needs to take place there to keep the garden going. And then finally, you have the community of people who are indeed actually doing the gardening, who formulate certain rules of and arrangements by the tools or what have you. So those are basic. That is basically the triad that Louis was mentioning of commons, commoning and community.
Yeah. Can I ask you something back? Is the claim here ultimately that commoning is a constitutive feature of a community or a constitutive feature of doing community?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I think actually, if we really take this triad seriously, then it means that neither of these ingredients, so to say, can really exist without the other. So I guess in a minute we will also go into other concepts of community, but this triad in a way already hints to the idea that there is, in the first place, no commons without community. So that this is a kind of phrase of Silvia Federici, for instance, that a commons always requires a community to look after it. But you could also turn this around, that there is no community without commons and without commoning. So that indeed the community, as you just phrased it, is indeed constituted by the work of commoning.
Yeah. No, I agree. I would say each of these elements of the triad of commons, commoning, and community requires the other and can take different forms. I would say an interesting example beyond the community garden here and also in urban context would be this idea of the community land trust, CLTs, which shows us something very interesting, I would say, which also touches upon the central claim that we'll be making, which is, again, community is a form of doing together because of a shared responsibility and mutual care towards each other and not an owning together. And so I think the community land trust is super interesting here. Community land trust, something that's, as so many other things, flew over from the US to Europe. I think even Bernie Sanders played a huge role in the popularization of this idea, meaning that a group of people, let's just say, to keep it simple, an urban community, large or small, joins hands around a certain urban resource, be it a piece of urban land or and the building standing upon it, and brings it into common ownership. Yeah, so CLT, community land trust. In order to, because of course the price of buildings is so much related to the price of land, in order to keep the price stable, in order to go against speculation and privatization, and also to put up some sort of collective governance system whereby people discuss and deliberate with each other, what are we doing with this land, what are the governance rules of our building. So really taking land out of the market. That this is a bit the same idea as Stace described about the community garden. On the one hand, it can be privatized, commoditized by the commodified by the market. On the other hand, it can be, let's say, yeah, simply commoned or commodified, to use a neologism, by the community. And so I would say in the community land trust, we see very clearly these three elements. There's the common resource, the land. There is the commoning, the people actively getting this resource out of the market, the people actively deliberating with each other, how are we going to sustain this land, what are the governance rules, how do we relate to each other, and thirdly, of course, the community. But this, I would say, also opens up a very important question, because where is there is the community is present, of course, if you're following my example, if you can imagine something with it. So the community is there and the resource and the commoning. But yeah, what kind of community is it? Because all too often we might say that a group of people doing this together might be a community based on the owning together. Like, we are a community because we're owning this land, or we're owning this building. And the direction that we want to push the episode in is to explore the difference with this other kind of community, whereby we say our community is not just based on the fact that we own this land together, but also that we have mutual responsibilities towards one another, that we care for one another, that we are humans all together, humans with needs, and we're gonna take care of that as well. Because, and we'll be talking about the different pitfalls of communities and commoning later on, but I think that this already is an issue when it comes to community. It's not always ethical, or yeah, how will I phrase it? The fact that people or doing or owning something together does not always mean that it's a real community.
So let me ask you what you mean by owning when you refer to this in the context of commoning. Is this a reference to a legal property title, or is this to be understood in a more broader sense?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say, first of all, that when we're talking about the commons and commoning, we would immediately think of it as something that is opposed to owning, and that is opposed to, like, the more classical legal understanding of property. We might look at this distinction between commodification and commonification, like the commodity and the commons. And the commodity is what is legally owned on the one hand, whilst commoning and the commons is what is shared on the other hand. So That's the first thing. For example, Dardot and Laval in common, they say precisely that the commons cannot be owned. The commons cannot be property. It can only be shared. So that's the first thing. But on top of that, I would like to add, let it be a provocation or a suggestion or whatever you want, that when it comes to urban development and urban dynamics, it remains still interesting to look into legal forms of property and legal forms of owning. And I read this in a book by Dan Webb, who said, if you just see commoning as merely sharing, you immediately put yourself in a subordinate power relation. You may say, okay, we're going to share, but whether you want it or not, like the city and urban dynamics is still based on the legal understanding of property. So therefore, we might also look into the legal understanding of property, even when it comes to commoning. And there are very potent forms of legally inscribed collective properties, such as the community land trust. This is legal, this is property, but it's collective property. So again, just as a provocation, we might understand ownership in two ways, like as a collective sharing, but also in its legal form.
So perhaps I could do a little bit of zooming out and discuss a more wider background, I guess, of the concept of community and how it has figured in philosophical debates, political philosophy, social philosophy, phenomenology. So on the one hand, I guess you have this kind of liberal tradition of thought that is actually considering community to be something of the past that is not really that pertinent or important anymore in contemporary modern societies. So of course you have this kind of familiar distinction that is made by, for instance, Ferdinand Tönnies between Gemeinschaft und Gesellschaft, community and society, in which community refers first and foremost to familiar bonds, family ties, very often associated with smaller villages, but indeed also perhaps has this more negative connotation of being closed off, being homogeneous. And on the other hand, you have the concept of Gesellschaft or society, which is indeed open, based on institutions rather than on family ties. And which more or less consists of a collection of isolated individuals. And there you have already a kind of tension between those kind of concepts that, of course, the notion of society as opposed to community has a kind of promise of liberation and emancipation, but has the kind of downside of also being perhaps alienating. And I referred already in the very beginning to my interest in the work of Walter Benjamin. And I think Benjamin very much has written about this kind of dual nature of the urban experience as, on the one hand, emancipatory and liberating, because basically you could become anyone you wanted. Your background did no longer matter anymore when you entered the city, because you became part of this kind of anonymous crowd of the city. But of course, on the other hand, this is also a kind of alienating experience, which can be very 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 problematic. So this is in a way, you might say that the liberal tradition casts away the notion of community, and any kind of attempts to reestablish a community is very often rather associated with conservative traditions. If you think of communitarianism, for instance, or even if you move further to the right, indeed the kind of community that Louis was already referring to, defined by particular properties, certain characteristics of indeed blood or skin color, ethnicity, culture, etc. Now, what interests or what has interested me has been a few philosophers who have tried to get out of this kind of either or dualism of community. So I'm thinking here of figures like Jean-Luc Nancy and also Roberto Esposito, who were trying to think community anew, especially in the wake of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and try to think of concepts of community without somehow falling victim to any kind of, let's say, authoritarian seduction of some sort. And indeed to think of different ways to think community. And especially here, Roberto Esposito interests me. So I want to tell you a little bit about how he thinks about community, and if if this goes into details, too much details, or if it becomes boring, then don't hesitate to stop me short, because well. Philosophers perhaps tend to philosophize. but what I find interesting in Esposito is, first of all, that he doesn't buy this liberal opposition of community and society, because he says that this kind of definition of community on the basis of what he calls the proper, So indeed family ties or a kind of common communal property is actually not the right way to approach a community. And he indeed radically opposes this and says that the common is not the proper, but rather the improper. And what he means by this is that within this concept of community, there is already a kind of ambiguity that from the outset rules out any kind of emphasis on familiarity or sameness. And the way that he does that, and the way that he explains that, is indeed by looking at this concept of the common. And he goes all the way back to a Roman law and the whole kind of etymology of the concept of common and community, and he points out that community and common are derived from the Latin cum munus, in which munus is not so much a shared property but a shared responsibility. I think he literally names it, again with reference to Roman law, a gift given but not received. So the munus is the gift given but not received. So it's rather, the munus is rather an indebtedness, so not something that one has, but rather something that one owes. And this indeed brings him to define community not as a shared property, but rather as a shared lack or a void, as he sometimes also calls it. And at a certain point in his book on community, he literally says, what we have in common is niente, with a kind of Italian play on words, niente, means both nothing, so what we have in common is nothing, but it also is no thing. It is so. It's not a thing that we have in common. Now this may sound like a kind of play of words, and perhaps rather abstract, but if you think of examples of this, actually one is quite familiar, I guess, to most of us, namely the idea, the traditional idea of the Christian community or communion, the idea that people within the Christian tradition are supposed to, and very often this was of course not the case, but they are not supposed to be bound by any kind of property or shared characteristic, but rather by what they lacked. Namely, what they lacked was Christ who was sacrificed, and the community consists precisely in this shared lack. And this is also why, for instance, St. Paul said that there are no Jews and Romans, etc., etc., and that we are all brothers in Christ, as he called it, of course, with this kind of gender bias that that is very much part of the Bible. Now, back to Esposito, he basically says that throughout modern history and throughout modern political history, there's been this kind of constant inclination to fill this void or to replace the nothing of the munus with something. And this is what Esposito also calls immunization. So instead of the community, you have the immunus, so the kind of neglecting of the responsibility or trying to get away from the shared responsibility. So this is what he calls immunization. And I think this concept of immunization, of course, today with the pandemic has got quite a particular meaning if we think about herd immunity or group immunization. But of course, it has also been quite often used in political contexts to refer to border security or the removal of illegal immigrants as a form of immunization of our political body. And I think what Esposito thinks, I think, shows very convincingly and interestingly, is that any such attempt of immunization always goes at the expense of the community. That any kind of immunization always also involves the destruction of community too. So I guess if we translate this back to the commons, I think based on these ideas of Esposito and others, I think you can see a very close connection between this particular notion of community that he tries to develop and the discussions on commons as something that we do not own, but a kind of shared responsibility and a shared praxis. So again, the commons also defined not as something that is owned, but something that is shared and that we cannot and should not indeed define as property.
Yeah, but I think it might have been like an excursus to Esposito and a play of words, metaphorically or etymologically. But I think here we reach really the crux of the episode and of the point that we're making here. Community not as the proper property owning together, but as a practice. But even there, we need some more nuance, which you have already brought to us via Esposito, like a communal practice because of mutual responsibilities towards one another, because a shared practice of doing together with each other, of mutual care because of shared lack, you might say, the munus that's been taken away. And so despite Esposito's etymological abstract inclinations, I think this is extremely relevant, this work, to think about community also in a contemporary urban context. If I may just coin a number of additional examples, I would say that many conservative non-emancipatory leaders today, I'm thinking about, the list is very long, Orban in Hungary, Le Pen in France, De Wever in Belgium, they all appeal, I would say, to community as the proper, as the owning together of this certain land, of this certain ethnicity, of this certain static identitarian culture, you might say. Whereas on the other hand, I would say, on the contrary to that, the uprisings about which we were talking at the beginning of the episode, Gezi Park in Istanbul, Syntagma in Athens, Occupy, this is precisely community because of a shared leg. This is community formation because of the shared, because of people are collectively deprived of whatever it is, housing, money, social services, sustainable urban spaces, and so forth. So I think the European summer of 2012 and afterwards, despite its short-livedness, is maybe the best example of community as a practice because of mutual responsibility towards one another. Something that also came to mind when you were talking, Thijs, is that Hart and Negri, in their book Commonwealth, they point to three social realms. You might say three sorts of communities that at first sight might appear to us as some sort of really romanticized, sustainable community, but in their view, they are really what they call corrupted commons. They speak of the family, the corporation, and the nation state. So three different social levels, you might also say, the micro level of the family, the meso level of the corporation, and the macro level of the nation state. What they say, this is also like a closing off of community. We're sharing things, of course. A nation is, of course, based on sharing. The corporation, the factory, is, of course, based on sharing. But this is also a closing off of community, a very clear definition of who's in and who's out. And last example, when you were talking about immunization, you might indeed, of course, say that a lot of how shall we call it, authoritarian interventions in the urban public realm, or very often, quote unquote, in the name of the community. For example, I was seeing these benches in the city, and they have pins on them to keep homeless people and people that sleep outside on these benches during the night, to keep these people away. Why? One might say in the name of the community. Also, CCTV surveillance and all kinds of privatizations and enclosures in the city is very often done in the name of the larger community or in the name of the collective safety. So that, I think, is a really tangible urban example of what you called with Esposito immunization might mean. We're making ourselves immune to the threats of the community.
Maybe I can sort of try and pick up on that point and see if maybe, Luis, you want to say something about the urban aspect of it, because I think this is a great, you know, the Esposito perspective is a great perspective in the sort of philosophical thinking about it, and the connection to the commons is quite clear. But I wonder what it means, say, on the actual level of doing, which I think part of the listeners of the podcast are doing, right? Like concrete empirical stuff, little projects in little cities, and not necessarily we're not necessarily all great thinkers with great ideas, right? So I think partly the discussion about community has been taken on in urban studies as under the banner of conviviality. So I think the Paul Gilroy perspective on conviviality is an attempt to think about convivre in quite similar ways, in strikingly similar ways, I think, than as the debate we're having now, which kind of indicates first, I think, that it's a tremendous big field, like, to talk about community, and second, that the various ways in which empirical work in urban studies has developed has talked about community without necessarily referring to the philosophical understandings of community, and not necessarily understanding that there is this long philosophical tradition. And kind of, you know, I think both sociologists like me and geographers are quite good in inventing new things and then figuring out, as philosophers who've already written about it, and the other way around, philosophers inventing new things that sociologists and geographers have seen on a very concrete level. So maybe that as a first point. And if I can sort of ask a question from the side of the more empirical oriented part of the field, maybe, is I'm wondering a little bit, I'm struggling in my head with this idea of the mutual responsibility and the collectively deprivation, and the idea that the shared responsibility, now the gift given but not received, that's wonderfully said, but if you're giving the gift, someone is receiving it. So I wonder how, if this means that community is always free of power, because if we're all giving gifts and we're not receiving, we're all kind of equal, and if you're all collectively deprived and all mutually responsible, then we're all wonderful and have this sort of very romantic, after all, vision of community that is inherently egalitarian. And I wasn't quite sure if I understood you right, Louise, when you made that connection to dictatorships like the one in Hungary, because isn't this also a way of telling a group of people that they have a mutual responsibility towards each other and that there is a boundary? Is it conceptually possible to differentiate between a group of people doing things for each other in a very exclusionary way, but they're still taking mutual responsibility and they're giving gifts and not receiving them? It's just that they keep other people out. But it's inherently not a non-community. It is not or maybe it is, and I haven't quite understood this part, the mutual responsibility because of a shared lack. I wonder if right-wing people think that they have a shared lack.
Well, I'm not saying that it's not a community. I would say just a different sort of community. And, well, still building further on Esposito, I would say that there, well, of course, people would say in all kinds of community, emancipatory, regressive, whatever you want, that there's always a shared leg, there's always a goal in the future that you want to reach, be it urban emancipation, be it your nation being closed off. So there's a continuum of shared leg, you might say. But the real difference, I would say, between, if we want to draw these differences, is that in the examples that I spoke about, of Hungary, Belgium, France, is that there still a form of immunization is going on, that these communities try to fill the void with the great leader or so, or with the instituted society. Whilst on the other hand, this real cum munus community that Thijs and I are thinking about building further on Esposito and thinking about shared leg, and from there on out shared responsibility, those would rather be, and I will problematize it in a minute, those would rather be, like, for example, the uprisings that we saw at Syntagma in Athens, at Gezi Square in Istanbul, Occupy. But I would be the first to say we shouldn't romanticize this either, because, well, you might say during the uprisings, let's take Occupy for a moment as an example. This, I would say, is like a school example of a community coming together and saying, we have a shared leg, there's something taken away from us, and therefore we have a mutual responsibility towards one another, and we're going to take care for each other. Mm-hmm. But what we see here is the problem of unsustainability, I would say. Occupy, and of course there are still activist groups working hard today, and who knows what will happen in the future, but Occupy and the other square occupations during the European summer, they died out quite quickly, precisely because of the lack of very clear demands. And that's what authoritarian regimes would do. They would say, these are our demands, we're going to do it in this and this way, this is our leader. So going back to the squares and going back to Occupy, what we saw there is like really the community formation based on shared leg, but unfortunately in a very quite short-lived way. You might say these communities sprung up on the squares, but after these first effervescent moments of high energy and high drive, they dispersed also quite fast. So I would dare to draw a difference between different kinds of communities, but I also wouldn't want to romanticize the one or the other.
Now, the sociologist in me then thinks, why is this a community and not an interest group or a social movement? So what is the added value of stretching this, the concept of community and its sort of identity connection, right? Because that was the, now that you said the identity, identitarian culture, now it should not be the focus. The focus should be the mutual responsibility. So where there is a set of studies, of course, that says that community and identification as a process are very closely connected. So could you elaborate on and maybe Thijs, you want to come in on this from a more philosophical perspective, what the connection then is to identification and community in that particular setting, maybe of the Occupy movement? How important is it that there is a sense of identification or social identity in the concept of community? Or is this moving away from it into the shared responsibility, the gift given but not received? Is that responsibility completely detached from any form of identification or social identity? Or are these things still connected?
Well, I would say it's both. Well, my analysis of, to stay with the examples of the square occupations and of Occupy and so forth, my analysis would be that there is among these, I'm going to use the word social movement and community now interchangeably, but among these communities, there is a inherent drive for non-identification. An inherent drive for, let's say, horizontal organization, for decentralization, really an intrinsic unwillingness to identify as a sort of homogeneous static whole. But on the other hand, you might also say that if a community is to gain any potency or any political traction in urban politics, then identification or some sort of identification might be necessary. Before I finish, Thijs, maybe you might want to say something about the argument Hart and Negri make in assembly about still the need of leaders or the use of leaders in non-identificatory contexts. That's what I wanted to say.
Before we move to Thijs, when he can come back to us, can you clarify this one more bit? Because when I pass an Occupy movement group, they look like a group in Merton's terms, like group category. You know, Robert Merton has made in this what I find interesting differentiation between a group, a category, and a collective. Right, where they look like a group, like they look like people who both know each other, hang out with each other, and have a sense of identification with each other. But it's pretty much similar. They look pretty much alike, right? In the way they dress, in what they eat, in what they drink, in how many vegetarians there are. I'm stereotyping this now on purpose to get us in a provocation, right? But is there no aspect of when you say it's an attempt to non-identify, you seem to have a quite clear understanding of what you mean by identification and non-identification. Maybe for us listening to you, it'd be good to know what that is.
Well, yeah, I'm going to come back to your active provocation in a bit, but I would say let's just look at a slogan like the 99%. This is like, for me, this is the giving up of any of separate identities. I would say this is, to speak with Hardin Negri, a coming together of different singularities, but a giving up of the idea of the static identitarian community. But what you're saying is also right. If I may just coin another example, and this is from a chapter in a book that I'm publishing together with Thijs this spring, called The Rise of the Common City, also co-edited together with Pascal Hiele. And in it is a chapter about an example that I would say is very significant in the context of the discussion that we're unraveling here. And it's about the Cambatlo Cultural Center in the La Bordeta neighborhood in Barcelona. And so this is an old textile factory claimed by different community groups as a form of opposition against the urban government. They transformed it, as we see in so many other places throughout Europe, into a sort of cultural center with all kinds of community use, spaces for community use, governed by assemblies and direct democracy and so forth. So you know the broader picture. But this article tells us and shows very clearly how, despite its community orientation of this project, some people might still feel excluded from it. So there's this example of someone who went into the cultural center. They also have a library, and he wanted to get a book there. And he felt really that, he says, when I go in there, people immediately look at me because, and this is exactly what you said, because I am dressed differently. I was wearing a suit, and I wasn't feeling welcome in this cultural center / squat. So you might say that despite the non-identitarian, decentralized orientation of community-based organizations nowadays, whether it's this cultural center or whether it's Occupy or the Square Occupations, there's always this inherent tendency towards enclosure, you might say, in community formation. And with that, I know I haven't really answered your question of, is Occupy a group or is it a movement or a community? Or I haven't put any specific concept on there, but I don't think in this discussion this is really necessary now.
No, I think that has clarified for me a lot, that relationship between identification, identity, and that what happens on the ground and what the conceptual ideas behind it is not necessarily the same, right? That there's mm-hmm. And also that it's a challenge to the wish for the, I like this sentence very much, the wish for the gift given but not received, that the utopia of trying to put that to practice then ends up with people saying, well, I wear a suit, I don't feel okay here, which shows the tremendous challenge, I think, to do that, those things in concrete urban life. Thijs, you were out for a little bit, but I think Louis wanted to push a question towards you. Maybe Louis, you can repeat that question and Thijs can pick it up there.
Yeah, I wasn't really asking a question. I just wanted to pass the ball to Thijs. But yeah, where we left is, yeah, this inherent tendency towards enclosure in every social realm. Just to finish off quickly, commoning, community has this built-in idea of openness. But we might say in whatever social realm will be, whether it's the market, of course, there, but also in the public sphere and in the sphere of the commons, there's always going to be some sort of enclosure or exclusion as a provocation, I would say that. So Thijs, maybe you can shed some thoughts on that as well.
Perhaps one thing that came just came to my mind when Talia was talking about this distinction between a social movement and a community and an interest group. I was reminded of yet another triad by sociologist Eric Olin Wright, who wrote this beautiful concise book, which is, I think, titled How to Be an Anti-Capitalist in the 21st Century. And at a certain point, he makes this nice distinction that he says, well, any kind of group or movement can be centered around either a certain identity or a certain value or certain interests. Or actually, he does not see these as excluded, but rather points out that each movement rather requires, to a certain extent, all these three. So both identities, values, and interests. Although, of course, in different social situations, the emphasis can be more on the one or more on the other. And of course, this does not answer your question or solve the problem that you were pointing at. But I just wanted to bring this in also as a kind of a potential analytical tool that you can actually use to study social movements or communities or interest groups to see whether there is indeed an emphasis either on kind of shared identity or shared values or shared interests. Yeah, so that was one thing that I wanted to mention. And I guess the other thing, let me think, what were you discussing, Louis, about this kind of inherent tension of the community that always tends to close itself off, even if it starts from such a situation of openness. I think this is indeed something that you very well already explained, and I think in our book we also talk about several situations in which commons can be corrupted. And then one thing that came to my mind here also was again from a drawing from Silvia Federici, that she very much criticizes the labeling of so-called global commons. And so I think it was the United Nations which has labeled certain natural heritages such as the Amazon rainforest or other parts of nature as so-called global commons. This of course is out of very much idealistic purposes, you might say, but she says that in practice very often this does not at all play out the way that this is intended, and rather is used as a kind of reason to move out certain indigenous communities from their lands and to open them up for tourism or even for companies to destroy such natural resources. So that is also why, and I quoted this also already in the beginning, no commons without community, why she says that if this label of global commons is not at the same time, as it were, attached to a notion of who is supposed to be responsible or who is supposed to manage these commons, then it's basically an empty label. So it goes in that regard a bit in two directions, that if you have commons without community, that is very much problematic. But if you have the community without sharing or this notion of openness, then it will also be corrupted in a way.
Can I ask you for one clarification on that? Because now I'm confused, because I thought to understand that the idea of the kind of community where we talk about and the commons presumes that there's no ownership, that it's against the idea of property. And then when it comes to the Amazons, you said the indigenous and their land. So how I am to understand on the one hand that we're talking about community as removed from proprietary rights and ownership, and at the same time recognize the right of, in your example, of the indigenous and their land, because it seems to me that the notion of their land is inherent difficult to combine with a community that is open, that has openness.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really good point. I guess their land, as I put it, would in that context not so much refer to use the Marxian phrases, not so much to trade value, but rather to use value. It is their land to extent that to the extent that they have used it and have a kind of history of using it and managing it, which does not mean that it's theirs to sell, for instance, or to put on the market. This is sometimes in the literature also referred to as the usufruct. Am I saying this correctly, Louis? A kind of different kind of right based on use rather than on actual ownership.
Yeah, I'm super happy, Talia, that you bring in this confusion, because it shows again a problem, let's just call it a problem or an issue for this moment, with commoning, commons, community, because indeed there is this inherent idea of non-owning, of non-property. But as a reaction to that, there is also a set of urban scholars today, and I'm thinking most notably about someone like Dan Webb. So progressive scholars, emancipatory scholars, you might say, who really say if we are to engage in a potent emancipatory urban politics, communities need to define themselves against. Communities need to dare to enclose themselves as a way of saying who or what they are against, and as a way of saying what it still is that they own collectively. And he would even go so far that we need to re-instantiate this idea of property. Because you might also think about it like this, the very idea of neoliberal urban development is, and this is going to sound very contradictory, is almost based on the idea of the world or the city or urban land is everyone's. There's this inherent or this idea of we're all in this together, we're all agreeing, there is a consensus among all of us that the city is a collective good, which is of course very useful for property developers to say, well, if the city is everyone's, then I can of course privatize this or regenerate this part of the city. And so as a reaction to that, Dan Webb would say, well, communities need to invoke property. Property is still, and as a legal property, as you were saying, Marcus, is still very important if you want to engage in an emancipatory urban politics against neoliberal urban development. And to make the link again with the commons, I forgot the name of the authors, but they coined this very good notion, I think, of the uncommons. And the idea to say the world, not everything is common to the whole world, you know? So as a way of going against exploitation and extractivism by foreign corporation, of course. I don't know if this is a little bit clear. I know it sounds contradictory, but for me, this relates very much to this, to the confusion.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful for me to see that more clearly, and I hope I'm not the only one, because we're having this wonderful conversation that basically not just for us, right? So, and I think it also shows though that that community in urban studies has so many parts of the field that deals with it, and the urban commons and community, I think, is an extremely interesting aspect of the field. And maybe we can do another round if Marcus lets us someday, and combine that idea of conviviality and sort of public space and everyday interactions and stuff that goes on, that I think, Thijs, you kind of pointed to when you were talking a little bit about Simon and Tunis. And did you mention Simon? I think you did. The Gemeinschaft in Gesellschaft and these kind of things. So I think there's a lot to more to be said there. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a notion that, as this episode has shown, that once you start to talk about it and once you really start to excavate it, however simple it may seem, this idea of community, but once you start to excavate it theoretically, etymologically, and also empirically in relation to urban research, so many questions, more than answers, you might say, emerge.
And I think maybe as a last sort of point that I would want to say, and then we see if you want to say something, and then Marcus can wrap it up, is also that there has been appeals in urban studies to drop the concept, to say community is not the right concept to talk about. It's not, it's too biased, it's too much tradition, it's too located in tradition, or it's too vague, or it's too romantic. But I think if you're doing, you know, interviews with people maybe in the field, in your own case, when you're listening to this podcast and doing stuff on neighborhoods and all these kind of things, it's very often that people start to talk about it. So it remains a concept that is alive in the urban world out there. And therefore, I think we need to continue using it and continue the conversation.
Yeah, but perhaps to respond to that, I fully agree with that. And in a way, I think very often you see that the conceptual field is in a way also a battlefield, right? In that sense that certain terms are sometimes co-opted by either conservatives or the far right or by neoliberalism. If you think already of such a term as freedom, which we very much tend to associate with the free market and indeed with individual liberties. And I think I'm always very hesitant indeed when there is this tendency to just give up on certain concepts. I very often rather would argue that we should reclaim them, and then of course very much think about how we want to use them and why we want to use them. But particularly the concept of community, I think, still has much value that we should not too easily cast away, so to say.
Yeah. I totally agree as well. Indeed, you might say, as you said, Talia, it's too romantic, it's too biased, but I mean, community is an element, it's used in language, it's used in life, in urban life, and you cannot so easily erase that. So I completely agree with Thijs. Instead of abandoning the concept, let's reclaim it and give it a new, better meaning instead of abandoning it.
I think it would be interesting to continue that conversation from taking it and seeing maybe also in the moment that the book is going to come out, the book that we talked about in the spring, and what was the title of it again?
the rise of the common city?
Yeah, exactly. So then also to see how where that sociology debate on community and identification and community as an everyday practice. And the last things I've been writing about community have been very much on community as an urban practice, as something that emerges out of the effectively pretty much common sense kind of things that people do, is closer to the conviviality discussion of Amanda Wise and other people than it is to the philosophical discussion on community and commons. So it sort of brings maybe a possibility also to bridge those debates in the future. So it's less of a sort of maybe thought through theoretically idea in the end, and my own sort of necessity to write about it was to find a way out of that continuous contradiction between people saying community is things that people do in nice social movements and it's always there, and the other saying community is something that is traditional and sort of identitarian, and sort of try to take it out into a new conceptual field of how the urban is lived on a very mundane level of doing everyday practices, and how in doing things, very much located in the tradition of people like Richard Jenkins, who is not used in urban studies very much, who has written this little book on identity where it's very much about how you do community and how the sharing of doing things. And I think what I was trying to do in that urban community's urban practice was primarily to see how to make a bit of a toolbox, and there's a set of other concepts, public familiarity, and you know, I can go on and on for about this, but there's a set of other concepts that I try to put together with the notion of community as urban practice to then make sense of how to write about the urban cohesion, the urban fabric in two ways. And I think what Dönitz and them have been talking about, and as well as Durkheim, and I think this can also be seen in the Occupy movement in some ways, is an understanding of the urban fabric as knitted, as people that are networked together and linked together through being knitted together. And that is one form of community. What the conviviality discussion tries to do a little bit more, I think, also empirically in the work of Emma Jackson and Les Back, is to talk about how the urban is also a woven fabric of things that happen to bump into each other, but are not necessarily connected. And that through sort of Kaufman idea of public encounters, things that happen in public space, there is a sense of imaginary of mutual obligation, trust, care, that isn't organized, that is not popping up and disappearing again in concrete actions of people with similar political ideas, similar views, similar sort of dreams about how the world should look like, and that isn't commons in that sense, and it often takes place in highly privatized places and places where neoliberal cities have been built, like shopping malls and fast food restaurants and places like that, but where there still is that sense of that something emerges that is more than a fluid encounter where people then. So it's basically, maybe it's trying to say, and I'm working on this, so it's a long-term project, and you can cut this out if it gets too boring, but is that Simon got it all wrong when he said the Großstadt and the Geistesleben, when he had the thesis that all that happens in the city is the anonymity of people passing and the blasé attitude that they developed, that is both very male and empirically problematic. And that on the other hand, the idea that the commons or commonality or doing things together, being together in the community garden, or that is the only hope that we have for creating more communal cities, that I'm trying to find a way in between there somehow.
That's super interesting. In the introduction to our book, I sense a bit that it's a bit of a similar idea. We speak of urban intimacy.
Yeah, that does sound similar. I think I need to read that book.
I think we need to continue that conversation then at a different moment. But I really like to thank Louis and Thijs for laying out your ideas around community, your arguments, and for Talia for your constructive provocations that really produced a great discussion. And so thank you all very much for participating in this.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.